Milo, thanks so much for your time. It's always great to talk to you. I want to ask you about your life as a young man and your involvement in the American Indian movement during the Wounded Knee occupation, and I guess a little bit about what that was like and how that shaped your early years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my early years, you know, I grew up in a community that only spoke Lakota and really didn't have any electricity until I was like 16 or 17 years old. So during that time, I was off the reservation with my parents, who were migrant workers, basically in the western part of the state of South Nebraska. And so I got an education off the reservation. And I always remember one of my school teachers, you know, says, "I'm going to teach you how to read and write." That's all she said. And because you can find out the rest of the information for yourself once you know how to do that, you know, because information is power, you know. And as a young man working in the potato fields, you know, this stayed with me. And as a result of it, I ended up going to University of Nebraska. And from there, I went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But, you know, those experiences led up to the whole idea of questioning the intents and purposes of a society, you know, and what we call the American dream, you know. And because if you look at it and do your research, the American dream is really basically a nightmare for the indigenous peoples in this country, whether you might be in New Mexico or Arizona or even South Dakota, North Dakota, like what's happening in North Dakota today, all of these. So, armed with the ability to read and write, I got to do a lot of researching, you know. And at Nebraska, I studied photojournalism, you know, and to satisfy my curiosity about why things were happening the way they were. And so as a result, that idea carried me through to what I'm doing to this day, and ultimately led my coming back and leaving the school, university, to come back to South Dakota to be part of what we call the takeover at Wounded Knee in 1973. And subsequent events after that, of course, you know, with the shootout with the FBI agents on the reservation in 1975. But the details of all of this, and one thing that I understood over the time, was that people are going to defend their positions, whether it's right or wrong. And they will use force in order to do so. And we that was a very painful lesson to learn from that period of time. But since that time, you know, I've been involved in, you know, trying to bring in better education possibilities to our people, economic development questions on the reservation, all of these types of issues. And I've got to a point where I was elected as the vice president of the Lugalau Sioux Tribe. And looked at the, at that time, you know, the burgeoning, the very infantile movement of what we call Indian gaming came to play. And so I got to be involved in the very formation of all the gaming laws and the Indian gaming laws that had been affecting the tribes clear across the state. You know, and it's a problem when you try to make a uniform system to fit a very dysfunctional area. You know, I'm not talking, I mean dysfunctional in a good way, in the sense that, you know, you're dealing with tribes that are speaking 500 different languages. You're talking about Indian tribes that are either completely urban within a whole city, within a, like Californian tribes, you know. But out here in the state of South Dakota, we're in a very rural area. And there's not more than 60,000 people within 100 miles of our existing casino. So, again, we have a lot of problems with this demographics. And but, you know, through that whole process, you know, I got to taking a look at the demographics of our areas that we're going to impact with this gaming. And I find out that, to my much surprise, or maybe I had an inkling of it, was that the non-Indian population in the western half of the state of South Dakota is going to be gentrified. And I mean, it's going to be over 55 years old already. And then the indigenous populations were very young. 16 to 17 year age medium was something that we had to look at. And as a result of that, you know, you can point to a lot of different problems with that. One, of course, is the health condition and the economic condition, you know. The state of South Dakota had prided itself in something called a Ready Fund, which was a pile of money that was going to be used to revitalize communities in the state of South Dakota, but has never been applied on any Indian reservations in the state. And you know, there are 9 reservations in the state. And as a result, a lot of this money that were voted into existence by, you know, the state of South Dakota has never been applied on the Indian reservations. And I believe that this is one of the problems that we have, you know, and the biggest problem that we have as a Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and the Oglala Lakota people is that it's unemployment. 88% unemployment rate. You know, and people kind of accept that. You know, the state of South Dakota prided itself in having a unemployment rate of 5.5% or something in this area, and pointed out that, yes, you know, we are meeting the unemployment rate and keeping it low, but it has never used the statistics on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation or any other reservation, for that matter, in calculating these unemployment rates. And as a result, it gives a real false image about the well-being of our peoples in the state of South Dakota. And so as a result, you know, we get to see these kind of situations that boggles the mind, you know, and our life expectancy on a Pine Ridge Indian Reservation is 58 years for men and a little bit higher for women, you know, but as a result, you know, we do have young families on this reservation, you know, faced with the tremendous problems that brought on by unemployment. So now, how do we meet the everyday needs of that population? Means that we have to rely on state-generated programs like the social services and Department of Public Social Services here on the reservation that meets the needs of our young families. And the tribe itself is doing a lot of things it can with the federal system itself. You know, that means federal dollars. Federal dollars coming to this reservation is tremendous. Almost 95% of the money that are on the reservation is coming from federal sources. You know, that means that schools, money for school teachers. We have the infrastructure needs that are done, roads, you know, bridges, all of these things are coming from federal sources. And so anytime, you might say that, as I think Felix Cohen has back in the day when he was the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, when he said that the Indians are like canaries in a mining shaft. He says, well, if they start fluttering, that means something is very wrong in that mine. And that's what the Indian people have served as for a long, long time. That we are first to recognize shortcomings of federal dollars to this reservation. But I recently heard and I read that the state of South Dakota issues $1 worth of taxpayers' money and gets $3 back in federal monies. And so we're not the only people who are totally dependent on federal dollars. The state of South Dakota is also quite dependent on the federal dollar. You know, and we have a lot of efforts going on now that, you know, if it hadn't been for the National Park Service, you know, where a lot of federal dollars are being created. You have the Department of Agriculture, which also does a lot of subsidizing of farmer products and that type of situations. But, you know, so more and more and more, if you look at the whole issue, you know, basically all of South Dakota is like a big one indigenous nation, you know, and we have to realize that because, you know, but there are many factors trying to drive divisiveness ideas among our people. And I think that this is something that a lot of people in Western South Dakota have to realize that, you know, in terms of our economic well-being and something somehow or another, an American dream for the future, for our grandchildren, their grandchildren, is really slipping away from us quite rapidly. And mostly because, you know, we look at the current situations that we see today, you see the idea of what's happening in North Dakota. You know, and I was very, very, very surprised and disheartened when I listen to the people who were downriver from the Missouri River, from this point up there in Cannonball, North Dakota, going south into South Dakota, that these communities who are dependent on having good, clean, fresh water coming from the Missouri River are against the people who are protecting the water. And this is really a telling blow. And I say that because, you know, we are all dependent on water. You know, our people have been saying that 3/4 of our human body is water, so we must keep it pure. And we also, in the Lakota idea of that, we must look into the eyes of the seventh generation. It's also something that we would like the dominant society in this part of the world to take a hard look at. You know, I mean, I don't want to be like Jamestown. You know, Jamestown. After Jamestown was settled, you know, in that first year, you know, they ended up eating their children, you know, and this is really, really troubling for me, you know, and I know that one time in my history, and one of the old gentlemen that I used to move with, you know, the Frank Fool's Crow and gentlemen like that, who told us, he says, American society is a society that eats its children, he said. And I didn't really understand what that meant, but apparently that's what we are doing. We're going to deny fresh water to our future generations, and that is something that is very, very troubling for me. You know, we should all, everything, you know, living on this earth needs water. I don't care what you are. You need water to live. And if you can't keep it clean and pure, you know, what's that going to be? You know, and this is a thing that I wish every people, a person in this part of the world, especially the western half of the state of South Dakota, that they should always keep the water pure. You know, because we can reflect a pure self. And this is the kind of thing that really is a... I hope that our legislature and our... captains of our industry and our business leaders and our education people would just get behind this idea of keeping the water pure and doing everything they can to do that, you know, and not allow, you know, because no matter what they say about industry, things do break down, you know, and 30 years from now, that pipeline that they're fighting against today might burst somewhere along the line, and they're going to unleash 55,000 gallons of crude oil into the Missouri River. And for even 1 hour, that's over 500,000 gallons of oil that's going to be into that water. And then who's going to drink it? You know, for all the fishing industry that is here in the state of South Dakota, especially along the Missouri River, what's that going to do to that fish population? These are things that, you know, I wish people would spend a lot of time, more time thinking about, rather their own today creature comforts, you know, because we have to start, somebody's going to have to start advocating for those future generations. And I hope that is the legacy of the people that who are living in the western half of the state of South Dakota. I hope that is their legacy, that they took a stand for water. It doesn't matter if you're red, white, or blue, or whatever the case may be, if you're crawling on the ground, or if you're swimming in the water, or if you're flying through the air, we got to keep the water clean and pure. And that is, if that's the only thing we ever did for our future generations, then we will have a future.
Yeah, there was a lot in there, but I want to start at asking about economic development. There's a stereotype. A negative stereotype in South Dakota that the reason things are depressed, the reason the economy is depressed on tribal nations in this state is because, quote, Indians are lazy. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in hearing Governor Mike Rounds. When he left office, he did an interview with us, and he said in that interview, I came into office thinking that places like Pine Ridge were poor because people there didn't have the incentive to get up and do work. And I'm paraphrasing Governor Rounds then, but then he said, when I got into it and I learned what was really going on, he said, no, it's there are barriers to economic development, there are barriers to business growth in Indian country that don't exist elsewhere. And I think you touched a little bit on that, but can I ask you any stories you have or any things you know of here on Pine Ridge where positive business growth could have happened, but it was stopped by a level of bureaucracy, tribal, state, or federal, that didn't allow that business to go forward. Are there any examples you can cite that might help people understand the barriers that need to be overcome to see positive economic development here on Pine Ridge?
Thanks for that question. If you go to a gas station today, on the wall and on every individual machine, it says, "We don't take out-of-state checks." And, you know, normally in the state of South Dakota, you have a local bank. In the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, we don't have a local bank. So we are now saddled with the responsibility of choosing a bank on this reservation. And sometimes we have to choose it in a place like a Martin, South Dakota, or in Rapid City or Hot Springs. But a lot of us are easier to go to Nebraska. So we have a checking account in Nebraska. And we have a checkbook from that bank in Nebraska. But when we go to our gas station to pay, what does it say? We don't take out-of-state checks. You know, and people might not think that that's very important, but it is one of the biggest, biggest roadblocks to economic development on this reservation. The lack of financial institutions benefiting indigenous population is just simply not there. And if it is, it's an antagonistic one. And that is something that we have to start working very, very hard on. Because ultimately, if we're going to see a prosperous Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and there's a lot of land on this reservation, there are beautiful sites on this reservation, hearken to an idea of having a tourist-based economic development system on this reservation. We have thousands and thousands of people coming to this reservation to take a look at what happened to the Oglala Lakota people. And, you know, we get so many people coming to Wounded Knee, and we come so many people coming to the Badlands. All of these things need an infusion of cash from the outside communities, you know, but we're not getting it. And we're certainly not getting help from any of the financial institutions because we are not in their service area. And, you know, this is what we call redlining, where monies can go that a bank has to follow. And I think that this is something that we have a big problem with.
We in the media sometimes are criticized for only reporting on negative things in Indian country, and so I want to ask a couple of positive things that we've heard about recently, even developments in the last 10 years on Kyle, the first motel that went in there next to Oglala Lakota College. I know the Lakota Funds has a federal credit union. It's not a bank, but it's a federal credit union. Their effort to offer microloans to small businesses. Many point to things like the Thunder Valley Development Community that is breaking down barriers. I mean, so I want to ask you about positive things we've seen, and are we in a good direction in the last, say, 10 or 20 years, and do you see good things happening in other avenues that I want to ask you about, too?
You know, that's a very good question, you know, and I have to say thanks to those people who are carrying out the ideas of the Lakota Fund or the Thunder Valley Development Corporation, because they have to do it, you know, by carrying, I mean, years of negative response and energy, you know, because you have to have a lot of energy just to do a little tiny step. And I know that that's something that we can take a hard look at. There's a lot of other entrepreneurial ideas that are coming on the reservation, and I think that that needs a lot of encouragement. You know, things like, you know, I think in the hearkening to the Red Cloud School, where they have the art show, you know, we have that there that's going on that allows our artisans on this reservation to have an outlet, you know, and we need to do more of those kind of efforts, you know, because there is no lack of effort on this reservation to, as they say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. There is no lack of it, but there are a lot of barriers, and sometimes people get discouraged after 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years of trying to jump over this. And that's one of the problems that we have on this reservation is that. And, you know, and again, it goes right back to the financial institutions or the lack thereof.
I should mention one of the positive economic developments here might be the coffee shop we're sitting in, where we can hear a smoothie being made behind us. It's a nice place to do an interview, but it sounds like a coffee shop, so I can mention that to our listeners. But thank you for that. And with that, I want to ask about maybe switch gears a little bit and ask about the importance of cultural survival and the cultural renaissance and maintaining the culture here and the language here on Pine Ridge. You mentioned that you were born into as a Lakota language speaker, and that's your first language. I know that you were also one of those who helped organize the first Bigfoot ride. And I remember hearing on Keeley Radio Alex Whiteplume talk about his camping in the first Bigfoot ride on one of the first nights. And you're kind of a big guy, Milo. They said you were laying down and everybody kind of laid in a row behind you because you were a windbreak. And I thought that was just a great story. But I want to ask you a little bit about what brought about the Bigfoot ride. What is it for those who don't know? And why are things like this important when it comes to maintaining and fostering and celebrating Lakota cultural identity?
And like all things, you know, it was built on a tragedy, what they call a tragedy of Wounded Knee in 1890. And back in 1985 and 1986, we were looking at the idea of what was going to do for the 1990 year about the Wounded Knee and how should we celebrate it or how are we going to remind ourselves what we went through. And so at that time, there was a lot of talk about so-called plastic medicine men, people selling ceremonies, all this kind of stuff, and they had a big meeting up in Eagle Butte. And so I went to that meeting as a journalist, and I interviewed the pipe keeper at the time, a man by the name of Stanley Lookinghorse. And Stanley, I asked him, I said, how should we deal with this? And he says, well, you know, it was a move from the southern part of the Cheyenne River Reservation, which is a place called Red Scaffold in Bridger, South Dakota, and ending up at Wounded Knee. And he said it started out on the 15th, and after we got word that Sitting Bull was killed up there on the Grand River. And so the people were running away from that murder and then getting on a horse and getting us. So let's see if we can duplicate that. And so we started doing researching, you know, and we find out that, you know, Bigfoot moved in the middle of the night, left from fires burning and came south, you know, across the north branch of the Bad River and across the southern branch of the Bad River and then finally onto the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation through the Badlands. And so we started, said, okay, well, let's go take a look at this path, you know, and we went down the line and took a look at it. And we decided to duplicate that, you know, how he was moving that night and on the subsequent 5 days later, ending up at Wounded Knee in 1890. And that itself, you know, decided to do that. So apparently 17 riders came from Standing Rock, I mean, from Cheyenne River down to Pine Ridge and started out a huge, huge movement. It ended up in 1990 with almost 370 horseback riders, probably about 150, 200 people walking, and just an explosion of, you know, an expression of self-pride through tragedy, you know, and I think, and then duplicating that, you know. But, you know, I'll tell you one thing that really was positive in that whole process, not only that's the explosion of self-pride of being a Lakota, but the people that helped us along the way, from Bridger down towards the fork of the rivers, you know, we were people there, you know, opened up their houses, opened up their barns, gave shelter to the horses, gave a feed to the horses, and came all the way down into the Badlands itself, what we call the Bigfoot Pass at that point, and then back onto the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And, you know, to me, you know, that was the telling point, you know. You know, and I feel like, you know, if we get something started like that and that young people are picking it up, well, it's time to step back a little bit and let them do it, you know. And and that's what happened, you know, and every year that's been going on, you know. And if I had been a windbreak in those times, wow, let's have a windbreak again, you know.
Yeah, and it's got to be great to see it still happening and to see it still, I'm sure, helping empower young Lakotas who are able to make it, I'm guessing, almost a rite of passage to be able to get on a horse and ride through the South Dakota winter to commemorate this event. That's got to be heartening for you, too, to see that still going.
Well, yes, very much so, because, you know, they call themselves Trokahia riders, you know, which is the future riders. And, you know, and the thing is that it allowed them to research their own history. You know, what the Stanley Looking Horse said back there about starting out there, running away from what happened to Sitting Bull. Well, see, the whole thing is happening. That was the Grand River. Just north of that is Cannonball River, you know, and what's going on there, and standing in defense of the future through our own history. No matter how sad and how tragic it may be, we can build a future on it, and that's exactly what we want to do. So for me, it is very prideful. It is very empowering for me to do that, and I'm glad that every day that, you know, people are coming down from there and riding in with this winter time where there's sometimes it's very nice and other times it's, and like in the 1991, I remember it very well. It was very, very, very cold, and it was like minus 50 degrees, and the wind was blowing like crazy, and people were still out there happy and willing to sacrifice that much to do so, you know. And that, at that time, I knew the heart and strength of our nation was going to be intact. And once it's intact, everything else can be done. And that's what I see as our future, you know. People got to start learning their language, you know. They got to start learning their ceremonial life. They got to learn about their family history. They got to learn about all of this, you know. And I think that behooves the, and I still keep going back to that idea about the help that we received from the non-Indian population between here and Bridger, South Dakota, you know, people opening up their barn doors, you know. And I believe if I went back there, I saw that the farm that we stayed at one night is abandoned, you know, and the old man and the old lady are both dead and gone now. But they opened up their doors, you know, let our put the hay out for the horses, you know, and that kind of thing. And he said, I may not understand Indians, he said, but I sure do understand horses. And they need hay and they need water, he said, and I'm willing to meet that need, he said.
That sounds like a great note to end this conversation on, and the future and the coming together of Native and non-Native. Milo Yellowhair, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you to South Dakota Public Radio, and support it all you can, and because it brings good things to good people and what they're doing on a daily basis. Pila maya pelo, nila wopila tranka.